Praise Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
So welcome back. I'm Josh Swanson. I'm the lead pastor at Christ Church in Sierra Madre, and this is our Through the Bible in a Year podcast. So last week, we introduced the book of Genesis, and today we are going to start working through the text verse by verse, line by line. So before we jump into this opening chapter of Genesis, I just wanted to say something that, there's so much that could be said about this opening chapter. I'm only going to scratch the surface. Any kind of insight that I'm going to yield from this text is going to be minuscule compared to all the depths and all of the riches that could be mined from these chapters. I mean, this stuff is so rich, and it's filled volumes and volumes of rich thinking. But one thing I just want to point out as we jump in that I think is important for Genesis 1 is this chapter has, unfortunately, for many, many Christians in the 20th century in particular, now moving into the 21st century, it has created an unnecessary divide and sometimes a hostility between science and Christianity, between science and faith. And I was reading something this week from a Christian biologist whose name is Daryl Frank, and he said this. He said, "Let us not allow a particular interpretation of God's precious word to become so central that it creates a gulf blocking the access of individuals to experience God's love in the church. I almost missed out, so why did the distance seem to me?" Isn't that interesting? He said, "I almost missed out on encountering the love of God because it was presented to me in my Christian formation that I couldn't really hold these two things together. My love, my interests, my study in biology, the whole academic field I engaged in, because people had pitted that against the Christian faith." And that's incredibly disheartening, and it's often the result of a misreading of this text. And so we want to walk carefully through this text. And I think what we're going to see as we come out at the end is almost the inverse is true when you enter this text. This section of the Bible, almost more than anywhere else, invites us into attention and careful study of the beauty and the intricacies and the way in which God's world works. In other words, to capture a vision of reality through the book of Genesis is actually to invite us to be a people who care about the world we inhabit, who are interested in truth and paying attention to how the world works. But I think to get there, we're going to have to walk through this text line by line. And so let's begin with Genesis chapter 1. Verse 1, it says this, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So what is he doing here in these opening verses? Well, here he says, "In the beginning, God created." That word created is the Hebrew word bara. And it's used five times in this text. And the verb throughout the Old Testament is only used to speak of God. In other words, the only one who does bara, who does this kind of creation, is God. And so he's describing a special kind of creation that theologians have referred to as creation ex nihilo. It's creation from nothing. And so I'm sitting right now at a desk. It's a beautiful, lovely desk made of wood. And on one level, it's proper to say that there was a human that created this desk, but it's a different kind of creation. It's a kind of making that's created from pre-existing materials. Back when my kids were young, I remember we'd be walking around town, and my wife would say to the girls, she would say, "Girls, who made the sun? Look at the sunset. Who made the sun?" And they would say, "God made the sun." And then she'd turn to a car and she'd say, "Look at that car. Who made the car?" And she would try to trick them, you know, like, because they might say, "Well, God made the car," you know, or if you're in Sunday school, "Jesus made the car," you know, because the answer is always Jesus. But, you know, once they kind of got the hang of it, they would say, "People made the car." And we would say, "God made the sun, and the people made the car with the stuff that God had made." And so human beings are sub-creators. That's part of what it means to be made in the image of God. We are makers ourselves, but our making, our creating is different than God's. We make from pre-existing materials, from pre-existing ideas. We create poetry and music and from pre-existing, you know, visual and artistic. We bring stuff together and we create new stuff. And we take pre-existing materials and we create, you know, furniture or houses or whatever, you know. But God creates from nothing. You know, my friend is a scientist from JPL. He's not a believer, but he's very interested in this conversation about the origins of everything. And he said to me one day, he said, Josh, you know, a lot of my colleagues don't like the M word. And I thought to myself, what's the M word? You know, I'm a pastor and a lot of my colleagues don't like the F word. So, you know, what do you mean? What's the M word? He said, the M word is mystery. And he said, but I can't get away from that word. He said, if you go back 13.8 billion years and you go back to just a millisecond after the Big Bang, and you were to put everything there inside a box and fast forward at 13.8 billion years and open that box, he said, you would have Shakespeare and John Coltrane. You know, you would have music and poetry and quantum physics. And he says, how you get from nothing to Shakespeare and Bach, that's mystery. And what the revelation in this text is that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God is the ultimate author of all that is. Oftentimes, there's a debate, you know, about, well, how long did it take? Was it 13.8 billion years? And is the earth, you know, 4.5 billion years? And when did the first life forms appear? And what was the process of lower life forms emerging and evolving into higher life forms? And can this be compatible? Listen, all of that is just child's play compared to the ultimate question. The real question is not how did it happen and how long did it happen. Once you answer that question, you haven't even got to the first base about what the real issue is. The real question is, why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there consciousness and beauty and bliss and goodness and music and philosophy and consciousness? Why do we inhabit a world such like this? What's at the bottom of it all? You know, there's a famous apocryphal story of the great philosopher Bertrand Russell giving a talk on astronomy. And at the end of the class, a young lady rose her hand and she was from a different culture and background. And as the apocryphal story goes, she said, I don't care what you just said. I don't care about your evidence. The world rests on the back of a turtle. To which he responded, well, what does the turtle rest on? And the woman said, it's turtles all the way down. And it's a way of getting at this idea of an infinite regress. Like, what's at the bottom of everything? And what the Bible is saying here, what's being revealed here, is that God is the ground of being. He's the ground of existence. At the bottom of all things is the Creator. And so here's the primal claim of our text, the fundamental truth that frames the rest of the biblical story and should frame our own reality. You and I are not the author of life. God, that infinite ocean of being and love and existence and joy, has donated existence to the rest of us. But listen, in a similar fashion to the story that the cosmologist tells about the universe, as a movement beginning some 13.8 billion years ago from chaos to a well-ordered and inhabitable universe, here the author poetically describes the creation as this unfolding movement from darkness and chaos to order and symmetry and beauty. Verse 2. Listen to the backdrop of the symmetry and beauty to come. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. That phrase, formless and void, is the Hebrew phrase, tohu vavohu. You know, and you just might try saying that at home right now, tohu vavohu, because it's just, you try that like at a party next time you're hanging out with some friends, just drop that ask him what you've been thinking about lately. Just say tohu vavohu. But the Hebrew scholar Robert Alter translates that as welter and waste. We imagine a vast expanse of a barren, lifeless desert. And then it says, and then there was darkness over the face of the deep. And for these ancient readers, being in a small boat in a chaotic ocean with a big storm in utter darkness was among the most frightening places you could ever imagine yourself being. And not because they thought that the ocean was morally evil, but because it would be chaotic and outside of your control and in the dark, and who's know which way is up. And here the imagery in the beginning, the earth was formless and void, and there was darkness over the face of the deep. And where is God in the midst of the tohu vabohu, in the midst of the dark foreboding sea? Look what it says. The Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. There was a time in the shadowy distant past when the earth was uninhabitable, when it was not hospitable or friendly to human life forms or any life form. It was a barren desert like Mars. And yet here, even here, the Spirit of God, it says, was hovering over the waters. You know, the verb used to describe God's spirit of hovering is used elsewhere to describe an eagle fluttering over its young. So it might connote giving birth or the nurture of her young children as the bird flies back and forth. And here is the venue, the stage of God's creative work. Here is where the Spirit of God is present, about ready to bring new life and nurture new well-being. It is in the midst of the darkness and the chaos. And listen, this is just a point in passing, but isn't it true that very often the stage and the venue of God's best creative work, of the new thing that he often does in your life, sometimes it comes out of the barren and the chaos, those tohu vavohu moments in your life. And so here the Spirit of God is hovering over the waters. And then the speech of God, verse 3, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. Notice, we get here the first word God speaks in the Bible. And God's first word is, let there be. And it's a sovereign and powerful word because right after he says, let there be, it says, and it was so. And this is the rhythm you find in each one of the panels or the days of creation. It begins with the speech act of God, let there be. And then the accomplishment, the powerful enactment of that word, and so it was. It was so. And it's interesting, isn't it, the language that's used here? God doesn't give a commanding voice. He doesn't say, now, get out here, light, and get out here, ocean, and get up here, land, and start growing. Instead, he says, let there be, which in some sense is almost as if God is giving creation permission to exist. You know, one of the things I've always appreciated about how Alicia, my wife, has been engaged as a parent with our daughters, is she's always let them be who they are. And I loved it. You know, we'd go to the park or whatever, and there might be a mud puddle and there's trees to climb. And, you know, there's some kind of helicopter parents that are like, no, children, you can't get your clothes wet. And no, you can't go in the mud. And so stay out. Keep your shoes clean and don't climb that tree. It's dangerous. But Alicia would be like, let it be, you know, like let kids be kids. Let kids be who they're going to be. Let them live into the full range of their joyful experience of this world. And that's in essence what God is doing in creation. He's letting creation, he's given it permission for it to become all that it was meant to be. Let it be. And then look what it says in verse 6. And then God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse, speaking of the sea below and the vast expanse of the sky with clouds, as the ancient people would imagine the water being held up high so that it could break through those clouds and bring down the water above, separated from the water below. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening and there was morning the second day. And then verse 9, and then God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas, and God saw that it was good. It's interesting, you know, in these first 3 days here, God is giving form to where it was formless. In the second 3 days, he's going to fill where it was barren and empty. And notice the first 3 days, there's a pattern. God is bringing order and symmetry to his created world. He's ordering the chaos. And so the first 3 days, notice he brings light from the darkness. He separates those. You have light and darkness. And then that's paralleled on day 4, where he fills the light with the sun and the darkness with the sun, or with the stars and with the moon. On day 2, he separates the sea and the sky. It parallels day 5, where he fills the sky with the birds and the fish with the sea. I'm sorry, he doesn't fill the fish with the sea. He fills the sea with fish. And then on day 3, he brings land to appear and causes, you know, the vegetation to flourish. And then he fills on day 6 the land with the animals. So do you see the first 3 days parallel the second 3 days? The first 3 days, he gives form and order. It's like he builds the house. And the second 3 days, he fills it. I would encourage you to just take some time, even when you're reading your Bible on your own, just note those first 3 days, maybe write it out, light, darkness, sky, sea, land, plants, day 1, day 2, day 3, and then note 4, 5, and 6, how those days are filled. Verse 14, and then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons, for days and years. By the way, if you know Ryan and Natalie Wiley, they put out a CD a while back. You can find it on Spotify today, called Signs and Seasons. You might want to check it out. I didn't ask them. I bet it came from this passage of the Bible. Of course it did, because they're Bible people. They love the Bible. Let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years. It is interesting to note that when God brings he brings the sky, or fills the sky with the sun and the moon and the stars, he notes that there is a purpose here. Creation is infused with meaning and purpose. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. I love that phrase. It's got to be the most understated phrase in the history of humanity. And he made the stars. You know, 400 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, some 400 billion plus galaxies. I don't know, Larry James, is that right? But something like that, you know, and he made the stars, appealing to the infinite power of God. Nothing is too hard for this God. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth to rule over the day and over the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. Note, each one of these days are set in this memorable kind of artistic, poetic frame. And I think it is artistic and poetic framing, because you notice plants were created on day 3, but the sun doesn't come until day 4. How did photosynthesis take place? Somebody asks. And then there's light on day 1, but the sun doesn't come until day 4. And you think, well, didn't the ancient peoples know that, you know, the sun gives light to the day? Yes, they knew this. But the point is that they are intentionally framing the story of creation in an artistic way, using the week as a literary frame. But notice what it says in verse 20. And then God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth and across the expanse of the heavens. And so God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas. And let the birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. You notice now we get another first. Verse 3 was God's first word, let there be. Here in verse 23, we get God's first blessing. God speaks a word of blessing. And get this, who receives the blessing? You know, I asked my daughter Lucy this morning. I was looking at this text, and I said, Lucy, who do you think was the first one that God blessed? And she said, was it Abraham? I said, no. Noah? No. Adam and Eve? No. Moses? No. Jesus? No. And I said, Lucy, God spoke his first blessing over the fish and the birds. I mean, think about this. Before human beings ever came on the scene, and if we can take, you know, the age of the earth that the scientific community tells us about, think about just how long that is. Literally, I mean, millions of years before humans come on the scene, God speaks blessing over his creation. Isn't that incredible? God blesses his creation. You know, there are no humans, and yet here there is God blessing and delighting in his creation. And notice in these verses, God declares his creation good. And of course, it's not just here. God said that the light was good, and that the expanse was good, and that the land was good, and the plants were good, and the fish are good, and the birds are good, and the living creatures of their kind. Verse 24, God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the livestock according to their kinds, and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. So God, in some ways, I mean, just think about this. God is looking out at his creation, and he is, in essence, saying, that is good. And, you know, why is it? I mean, you sit at a meal, and when you know, the steak was cooked to perfection, when that, you know, that beautiful wedge salad with the blue cheese and the bacon is on the side, when you have that nice glass of wine and you indulge in this delicious meal and you pull your chair back and you say, that was good. Or you go to the concert and you walk out and like the music made you feel alive and you just walk, you say, that was good. You know, and what are you doing in those moments? Well, you're not just giving factual information. You're bringing to verbal expression your inward delight. And isn't it interesting in our text, God is bringing to expression, it is good, his inner delight in creation. You know, God loves his creation. God loves his creation even apart from his human creatures. God has a relationship with his world apart from his human creatures. Now, of course, we are the highest of all of God's creatures. We are those who have been made in the image of God, and yet God still relates to his world, and he delights in it and enjoys it. One of my favorite texts in the Old Testament is this little verse in Psalm 104 where it speaks about God playing with Leviathan, finding joy. Proverbs 8, there's the personification of wisdom, which is a pre-incarnate picture of Jesus himself alongside the Father, who says, I was delighting in creation. God delights in his creation. He notices it. It brings him delight. And you know, one of the ways in which we will grow and our character can form when we are becoming more like God is when we share this same kind of delight in God's world. When you experience delight and wonder, when you practice that discipline of attention and you notice the goodness that is all around you with the trees and the birds and the flowers and the ocean and the mountains and the sunsets, and you're noticing and delighting, that is a way whereby you can become like God who delights in his creation. I remember a few years back, I was at a class up here in Sierra Madre with Dallas Willard. And I remember walking out in the garden one day, and there was Dallas sitting on a bench by himself. And it was curious. He didn't have a Bible. He wasn't reading a book. He was looking at a bee while it pollinated a flower. And he looked so pleased. And this was a man who had grown into more and more Christ-likeness. And one of the ways he grew in Christ-likeness was in his delight and his attention to God's creation. And listen, isn't this what a scientist does? You know, you think, is science at odds with Christianity? No. When a scientist is given attention and noticing and recognizing the patterns and the order and the behavior and studying the history of and how the created world around us functions, that scientist is engaging in a practice that is good. You know, I was listening to an interview with a theoretical physicist whose name was Tom McLeish, and he said that science is standing next to God with wonder and interest and carefully observing God's creation. It was David Attenborough who I think almost, you guys have seen the Earth movies, haven't you? You know, David Attenborough, the best of all hosts. The guy is in his 90s and he's still doing this work. You know, I was watching a video of him sometime in his 80s. He's out like scuba diving, you know, and just going for it, but just loves creation. But he said this, "It seems to me that the natural world is the greatest source of excitement, the greatest source of visual beauty, the greatest source of intellectual interest. It is the greatest source of so much in life that makes life worth living." And so after all of these 5 days of creation, where God is creating and he is declaring and delighting and speaking over and blessing his world, We finally, at the end of God creating, we humans are brought into the picture, verse 26. "Then God said, let us make man in our image and after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And so God created humans in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And God said, "Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth, every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and every bird of the heaven, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food." And it was so. And so God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. You know, next week, or our next episode, we're going to get into the weeds on this whole text about being created in the image of God. And we're going to bring that into conversation with the passage about the creation of the first humans in Genesis 2. But let me just note this. This text invites us into the created world. God calls us into being, and he gives us a role relative to the rest of the world that he has made. And what is that role? Well, number one, we are invited to enjoy God's creation. He says, "I have given you every, you know, fruit on the trees and every seed. You can eat and enjoy them." A little bit later, we're going to be offered meat, but here we're just given a vegetarian diet. But here's the point. Creation comes to us as gift. God has graciously donated to us not just our existence. He has invited us to live and inhabit this beauty and this goodness that he has brought into existence. And then he has said, you can enjoy it. You can indulge. You can eat and enjoy creation. You know, God has given us all things richly to enjoy. But not only has he graced us with the gift of enjoying his created world, he's also given us a mandate and a role, responsibility in his created world. And what is that role? What's that responsibility? He says, exercise dominion over creation, rule over it. In other words, our call is to go into the world and to exercise and to mirror out into the world God's own wise and loving stewardship over creation. We are to care for the plants and the trees and the animals and the land and the air we breathe and the quality of our rivers and our soil. And he says, I've given you this. I need you to care for it. You are responsible. You are a steward in my creation. And I want you to cultivate it. Go out into the world and take the raw materials of the world and bring out all of their fruition and their fullness. Go into the world and get eggs and make omelets, you know, and go out and take grapes, you know, and crush them and allow the juice on the outside to mix with, you know, the yeast on the outside to mix with the juice on the inside and stick it in barrels and let it ferment and take grapes and make wine and take wheat and make bread and take sound and make music and take words and make poetry. And take my created world and create art and architecture and beauty and bring out all of the fullness that's latent within the world so that it might benefit and bless the world. So he says, I want you to care for the world, and then I want you to cultivate the world. I want you to attend to the world. Now, let me just close where I began. I began by talking about this unfortunate hostility between science and faith, between Christianity and science. And I just want to say this, this text actually exhorts us to attend to the world, to understand the world, so that we might better care for the world and cultivate the world. And I guess this is a word to you scientists out there. You're engaged in your academic fields, and I'm sorry if the church has not always been an encouragement to you, you know, made you feel like you're doing the wrong thing, you're engaged in the wrong thing. Listen, all truth is God's truth. And go out into the world with this knowledge that God is the ground of all existence, that the world comes as gift and grace, and it comes from God's self to us. He's donated to us our existence, but he's invited us to attend to creation, to notice creation, to delight in creation, to experience its beauties, and then to care for and cultivate the world we live in. And so may those who are professional scientists do that, and may those of us who are amateurs, who are just called to go out and to attend to the world, engage in this world in this way. And we'll pick up where we left off next time we get back in. Thanks again for joining with us as we walk through Genesis 1. Again, we'll pick back up, talk about the image of God in our next episode. Look forward to being together with you again.
Praise Father, Son and Holy.